Michael will now do the reading.
So, thank you very much. Thanks for having me here again. I'm going to read a passage from a book I'm going to be talking about a little bit more in a little while. It's called Being Mortal, and it's written by Atul Gawande, who is a surgeon at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. In the end, people don't view their life as merely the average of all of its moments, which, after all, is really nothing much plus some sleep. For human beings, life is meaningful because it is a story. And a story's arc is determined by the significant moments, the ones where something happens. Measurements of people's minute-by-minute levels of pleasure and pain miss the fundamental aspect of human existence. A seemingly happy life may be empty. A seemingly difficult life may be devoted to a great cause. We have purposes larger than ourselves. Unlike your experiencing self, which is absorbed in the moment, your remembering self is attempting to recognize not only the peaks of joy and the valleys of misery, but also how the story works out as a whole. That is profoundly affected by how things ultimately turn out. For instance, why would a football fan let a few flubbed minutes at the end of the game ruin 3 hours of bliss? Because a football game is a story. And in stories, endings matter. When our time is limited and we are uncertain about how best to serve our priorities, we are forced to deal with the fact that both the experiencing self and the remembering self matter. We do not want to endure long pain and short pleasure. Yet certain pleasures can make the endurance of suffering worthwhile. The peaks are important, but so is the ending. So, thank you again for having me. A couple of years ago, a book club I was a member of discussed this book that I just mentioned, Being Mortal. It's written by Atul Gawande, who I mentioned earlier. He happens to be not just a surgeon, but also a gerontologist, a doctor who specializes in the care and treatment of older people. Now, notice, you can't read this, it's too small, but the subtitle of the book is Medicine and What Matters in the End. Not what matters after the end, but what matters in the end. Back then, my own personal reason for wanting to read and discuss this book had to do with my father-in-law. Charles was 92 when we discussed this book. He was living by himself on the other side of the continent. For years, my wife, Susan, and I had worried about him and tried to encourage him to come and live with us. Now, after reading this book and talking about it with my book club friends, there were three things that probably shouldn't have surprised me, but did in fact surprise me. The first surprise, I learned that for many people, for many older people, independence is a more valuable commodity than safety. Being able to live in your own home and make the simplest decisions about what you'll eat and when you'll go to bed are more important. Before that moment, when I thought about my father-in-law's situation, it was to worry about what we would do if he fell and nobody was around. It was to worry that if he had an accident because nobody was there to tell him he shouldn't be driving, if he choked on something and nobody was there to help him. I learned from reading this book that while he might worry about those things too, the risks were worth it. Getting up whenever he wanted to, spending the afternoon sitting in front of his house in a worn-out deck chair watching the traffic go by, or having a cocktail when he felt like it were worth the risk. The second thing that surprised me, as I just said, my concern had been what would happen to Charles and what would his life be like if he did fall and break something. What would the quality of his life be, and how could Susan and I make it as good as we possibly could from the moment he fell until the moment in the indefinite future when he died? Now, putting aside my own concerns about my father-in-law for a moment, that night when we book club members steered our discussion to our own impending deaths, a lot of us sort of skip that step, the one that comes between when you fall and later on when you die. People talked about what they had told their children about what they wanted to have happen once they died. Some had plans to give certain things away. A few even knew what they wanted their memorial service to be like. But when it came to questions about whether they had a plan for a moment when they could no longer take care of themselves, Nobody wanted to talk about it. And to be fair to my book club friends, they come by their reticence honestly. Look at the back of your hymnal. There's a section here that has a topical index. And by the way, I give you permission to look at this, to look away from me for a moment if you want to. There are headings: celebration and praise, courage and hope, family, justice and social action. Nowhere does it say aging. And as a religious culture, we don't like to bring that up. But I'm going to bring it up today. Because the third surprise for me when I was reading this book was, I wasn't just reading about my father-in-law, I was reading about myself. I'm getting older, and I can honestly say that I am not okay with it. And that's not all, because no matter what our chronological age is, we're all getting older, and none of us like it very much. When we look in the mirror, we see who we want to see. Once when we were on a visit to New Jersey to visit Susan's dad, my wife took a picture of her father, Charles, and showed it to him. He said, "Oh, you have a picture of Pappy," which is what Susan called her grandfather, his father. Charles was looking at a picture of himself taken a few minutes earlier and did not recognize himself. He thought he was looking at a picture of his father as an old man. A couple of months ago, I ordered something at the takeout window at Taco Bell. The disembodied voice told me it would be $4.64. When I got to the window, the cashier took one look at me and said the charge was $4.18. Now, I'm not stupid, so I kept my mouth shut and saved 46 cents. But when I got home, I looked at the receipt, and I discovered he had given me a senior discount. I didn't ask for it. He didn't ask me how old I was. He just took one look and decided this old man deserved a break on his tacos. So, outside of the fact that I saved 46 cents, the only other good thing about this is that none of you were there to witness the humiliation. And when I first started writing this sermon, I was tempted to be clever and not actually mention my age. But I changed my mind. I'm 64. I was 14 when Paul McCartney wrote and the Beatles first sang, "When I'm 64. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? When I first heard that song at the age of 14, I was scared to death of how 15 was going to turn out. So never mind 64. However, I now have my concerns. I worry about myself. I am 4 months away from 65. Technically, my mother did not commit suicide. But I do believe in the moment before she died at the age of 65, she did not try very hard to stay alive. Throughout most of her life, my mother was very charming, to the point that it caused her son, me, no end of embarrassment. And she was attractive. For most of her life, she traded on her charm and her good looks and managed to sweet-talk her way out of a lot of the jams she got herself into. But at a certain point, the charm and the good looks no longer worked, and she became what many older people describe as invisible. On what would turn out to be her last Mother's Day, I took her to a very nice Cuban restaurant where the darkly handsome waiter cooed and fussed over her, which she loved. Then about halfway through the meal, she looked over at another table and saw her waiter sweet-talking somebody else's mother in exactly the same way. That's when she said, "I don't think he really meant it when he was flirting with me." I'm sorry to say she died 7 months later. So I worry. Intellectually, I tell myself I can learn a lesson from how and why she did not decide she wanted to live beyond 65. I know that this body and this face do not define who I am. But still, I love it when I can make my friends laugh. But I find myself nailing the joke less and less frequently. I tell myself it doesn't matter, but there are days when I wake up, everything hurts and nothing seems funny. And I worry about how I will fill the days between now and the end. Again, another lesson from a parent, this time my father. My dad was a career military officer who fought in 3 wars. Now, despite the fact I am a knee-jerk, liberal, democratic UU, I love my father, and I don't begrudge him the fact that he loved his job as a professional warrior. But when the Vietnam War era ended, the Air Force had more generals than it needed, and he was forced to retire before he wanted to. at the age of 53. He had plans. He had ideas for second careers, but in the end, none of them worked out. Nothing was exciting as what he'd done in his first career. So he spent about 30 years watching reruns of Law and Order and grumbling about how the Air Force had ruined his life. Now, my career is not exactly over, but I know I'm much closer to the end than to the beginning. I have loved my life as a journalist and a writer, and unfortunately, there is nothing else I want to do. That is my own fault. I don't have a hobby. I don't collect anything. I don't have a passion for much of anything else besides my wife and my work. So I worry. And like many people, I worry about having enough money to last until Susan and I die. On paper, it looks like we do, but I've been around long enough to know people who began retirement without a care in the world live long enough to have to scrounge to make ends meet 20 or 30 years later. So I worry. And I return to Atul Gawande and being mortal. He suggests there are five questions doctors and families should ask people as they near the end of their lives. On one of the last times we visited Susan's dad in New Jersey, I did my best to ask Charles these five questions. It was not entirely successful. And I decided to ask myself the same questions, and I have to confess that I did not have many more good answers than he did. Here are the five questions. First, what is your understanding of where you are and of your illness? In other words, do you have a realistic sense of your physical condition? Now, all of us at every stage of our life get sick once in a while, and we have all been known to not have a realistic view of how bad off we might be. We've all blown a minor cold or a backache completely out of proportion, but some of us have also been known to deny the evidence of a serious health problem. At that time, my father-in-law just seemed to be old. He'd gotten forgetful, but he had never spent a single night in the hospital. So this question didn't interest him very much. On the other hand, I've had some serious maladies in my time, and I've probably spent a couple hundred nights in the hospital. I do think a general sense of optimism on my part has carried me through some difficult moments. But I worry about the time when the physical health problems stack up and a positive attitude is not enough to get me out of a jam. Second question, what are your fears or worries for the future? That is one that Charles definitely was not interested in answering. I already told you a few of my worries and fears. Third, what are your goals and priorities for the rest of your life? Charles' best answer was that he wanted to live on his own, as I mentioned earlier. As I also mentioned earlier, that's one question I am still working on. Fourth, what outcome is unacceptable to you? What are you and what are you not willing to sacrifice? At the time, Charles Bent's answer was, we'll talk about that when the time comes. For me, once again, a question I have to work on. Fifth and finally, what does a good day look like to you? For Charles, that was an easy one to answer. It was a nice, warm summer day, and he's sitting on his porch chatting with all the bikers and strollers who passed his house on the way to the beach. He answered that question during our last Christmas visit when the typically harsh New Jersey winter had momentarily taken a break and the weather wasn't so bad. But not long after we came home, the weather worsened and the snow and the cold kept him trapped inside his house. He was one of the few year-round residents in a neighborhood of vacation homes, and he went for days at a time without seeing anybody except the person we had hired to check on him, to buy groceries for him, and to clean his house. Then something happened the following February that made it clear even to him that he could not take care of himself anymore. Safety had trumped independence finally. So Susan and I went to New Jersey to bring him back to our home in Los Angeles. He took his first plane trip in nearly 20 years, and he did just fine. Because we were in charge of the menu, he began eating almost three meals a day and gaining weight. We got him to take a walk almost every day. He plowed his way up and down our stairs. He took an interest in what we were doing, and he even laughed at my jokes once in a while. Charles was looking toward his future with optimism. He learned from one of our neighbors who was fond of him that there was going to be a neighborhood block party, and he was invited. He worked on building up his strength so that he could walk down the street to the party on his own, and he did. While it wasn't total independence, It was enough to satisfy him. Remember that passage I read you earlier from Atul Gawande. For human beings, life is meaningful because it is a story. Your remembering self doesn't recognize only the peaks of joy and the valleys of misery, but how the story turns out. And in stories, endings matter. Charles loved to go out to eat. And one Saturday, about 6 months after he arrived at our house, he was in his bathroom shaving, getting ready for the three of us to go out to lunch. I heard a crash. Charles was laying on the floor. He'd suffered a massive stroke. The doctors tried everything they could possibly do, but the following afternoon, just as he had wanted, we removed him from all life support systems. Now, Charles' death should not be construed as an unhappy ending. It was the end of a story that mattered, not just to him, to my wife and me as well, because it was a story that he made sure had a happy ending for him. It was a story of a man who held onto his independence for 92 years and then surrendered it ever so slightly to those who cared about him and did their best to make sure his last months were happy ones. And I am hoping that, as I think now, a year later, about how his story unfolded, that I can once again ask myself those five questions, and I can learn something about how to write the end of my story, too. Thank you.
So our closing words will be from Michael.
Go forth. Because we are always going forth from somewhere, going from our homes, from our childhood, going from innocence to experience to enlightenment, going into mystery and questions, going into the desert, going to the other side. Go forth, leave behind the comfort and community of one place, head into the anxiety and loneliness of another, carry with you the love and laughter of this place, and let it light your way. Carry with you the wisdom you learned and the good memories. And when you have been away long enough, far enough, done what you'd set off to do, been there so long, that place too starts to feel like home, come back. Come back to the one universal, everywhere and everywhere and everyone. This beloved community of all creation that you can never really leave.